Welcome back to the Deep Dive. Today, we are really digging into the career of someone, well, foundational, an artist whose work pretty much defines American roots music over the last, what, 50 years?
Yeah, easily. But it's funny, his own name recognition, it often seems to lag behind the legends he played with or even the artists he influenced down the line.
Exactly. We're talking about David Albert Alvin. Born November 11, 1955, you could call him a true architect of Americana, of roots rock.
And that tension you mentioned, foundational, but maybe not always getting the spotlight. That's kind of what makes his story so
It
fascinating.
really is.
We're looking at someone who's not just, a musician, a singer, a producer,
Yeah.
but also a published poet, a really prolific songwriter.
And yeah, that Rolling Stone quote, they called him an underrecognized guitar hero, which feels about right.
Totally.
And when you look at his actual output, the sheer volume, it's this restless creativity, isn't it? It just refuses to sit in one box.
Absolutely refuses. He moves so fluidly between Americana, then bang, alternative country, straight up rockabilly, country rock, folk rock. Sometimes, like within the same album cycle almost.
It's incredible. And he even created his own persona, Blackjack Day.
Right, from the 98 album. Gave himself that moniker.
So our mission today really is to trace that whole journey. It's quite a path.
It really is. We want to understand how a guy starts out, helps launch one of the most, frankly, exciting roots rock bands of the 80s, the Blasters,
Yeah.
and then somehow pivots straight into the LA punk scene, like immediately.
Doesn't miss a beat.
No. And then navigates setbacks, gets his huge Grammy success, but in a totally different genre.
Right, folk music.
Yeah. And ultimately finds this really enduring voice as a master storyteller, even after going through a really, really tough personal health battle.
So we're really tracing a path of, I guess, resilience and constant reinvention.
That's it, exactly. Resilience is the word.
Okay, so if we want to get a handle on that unique mix of styles that Dave Alvin represents, we have to start where he started, Downey, California.
That's ground zero. It's the cultural incubator, right? Where he and his older brother, Phil Alvin, just soaked it all up. They developed this almost encyclopedic knowledge of American music.
Just growing up there.
Yeah, Downey back then, 60s, 70s,
Mm-hmm.
it was this amazing crossroads. American culture was really fermenting there.
So they weren't just listening to Top 40 radio.
Oh, not at all. They were digging deep, spending their time in venues, listening to actual blues artists, real rockabilly legends, hardcore country players, people who were living it.
Wow.
They were basically giving themselves a PhD in American musical history just by hanging out in those local clubs and bars.
That makes sense. I know he did technically attend Long Beach State University for a bit,
Yeah, he did.
but it sounds like his real education was happening in those, juke joints where the
Yeah.
music was alive.
Totally. And that intense absorption, that deep listening, it led directly to forming the Blasters. That was 1979.
Right. And it was him, Phil, and then fellow Downey guys, Bill Bateman on drums and John Baz on bass.
That core lineup. And the Blasters were, I mean, they hit the ground running. They were significant right away.
How so? What made them stand out?
Well, they were totally rooted in tradition. They knew their stuff, but they played it with the speed, the intensity of punk rock, which was exploding around them.
Oh, okay.
So they weren't just a retro act playing dress up. They were fusing these classic American forms, blues, rockabilly, R&B, with the raw energy of that moment. They were like the quintessential roots rock band before people were even really using that term widely.
Years before it became a common label.
Exactly. And what's absolutely critical, if you want to understand Dave Alvin's specific role in all this, yes, he was the lead guitarist, killer guitarist, but he was also their chief songwriter and incredibly prolific. People sometimes forget that because Phil Alvin, well, Phil had that voice.
Oh, yeah. An overwhelming, powerful voice. Perfect frontman.
Absolutely perfect for that role. But Dave was crafting the material. He was building the house.
That's a key distinction. And the Rough Guide to Rock even noted it early on, saying he matured into a great songwriter.
They saw it. And, let's talk about his guitar playing in the Blasters for a sec. It wasn't just standard blues rock stuff.
No.
No, it was aggressive, but also minimalist in a way. He blended like the sophisticated phrasing of T-Bone Walker, really smart blues licks with this furious stripped down economy of notes you'd find in punk.
Interesting combination.
Yeah. And that blend gave the Blasters their edge. It was clever music played really, really fast and loud.
And the proof was in the pudding, right? His songs started getting noticed outside their scene almost immediately.
Right away. The prime example has got to be Marie Marie. That
Yeah.
song didn't just stay in LA. It became a top 20 hit in the UK and Germany in 1980. but not by the Blasters.
Covered by Shakin' Stevens.
Shakin' Stevens. Think about that. A roots rock tune, Born in Downey, gets adapted for, like, European pop charts.
That's wild.
It shows how universal Dave's writing was, even then. It had that classic structure, great hook, deep enough roots that it could be reinterpreted like that.
And it didn't stop there, did it?
Nope. Buckwheat Zydeco picked it up in 87, gave it a completely new life with accordion, Zydeco style. That song just kept going.
Wow. Talk about legs.
Seriously. And another great example showing his range early on is Long White Cadillac.
Oh, yeah. Dwight Yoakam recorded that one, 1989.
Dwight Yoakam, Mr. Neo-traditional Bakersfield sound. And Alvin's song just slotted perfectly into Dwight's whole vibe.
It really did. A perfect fit. Proved he could nail that traditional country narrative, the structure.
And the fact that his songs worked so well for such different artists. Shakin' Stevens, Buckwheat Zydeco, Dwight Yoakam. That's the ultimate proof, isn't it?
Yeah.
His songwriting chops went way beyond just the Blasters' particular sound.
But yeah, that core Blasters lineup, especially with two intense brothers, it couldn't hold forever. Dave left the original band in 86.
Right. And look, there was definitely internal tension. That's almost standard issue for bands with brothers, especially fronting it.
True.
But the core creative issue really was Dave. He'd become this great songwriter, and he wanted to sing his own songs. And Phil was the established voice, the front man. It's a classic dilemma.
So he had to step out.
He kind of had to. It was maybe a necessary split for his own voice, his solo career, to really blossom. He needed to get out from under Phil's, you know, very large shadow.
Makes sense.
But what's interesting, though, is the connection remained. Despite the split, they've reunited over the years for tours, live albums.
Right, like that Going Home live album in 2004.
Yeah, and Live 1986 came out later. They even popped up together in that movie Streets of Fire back in 84.
Oh, yeah. Walter Hill movie.
That's the one. So it shows, you know, the day-to-day partnership ended, but the foundation, the shared history, that music.
Yeah.
It's still sacred to them. The bond runs deep.
So leaving the Blasters, it wasn't like he took a break. Not at all. It seems like it just lit a fire under him.
Oh, totally. Rocket fuel is a good way to put it. Mm-hmm. Instead of just retreating to work on solo stuff right away, he showed this incredible, almost kind of chaotic adaptability.
How so?
He just dove straight into the deep end of the Los Angeles alternative scene, which was really volatile and exciting then.
Right. And this is where he might surprise people who only think of him as, you know, a straight roots rocker.
Exactly. Because the pivot was immediate. His first big move, he joins X as lead guitarist.
X. Wow. That's a powerhouse LA band. Alternative rock, punk roots.
Yep. He recorded on their album, See How We Are. That was 87. Now, you got to ask, why would a guy steeped in blues and rockabilly seamlessly join a band like X?
Yeah, it seems like a stretch on the surface.
On the surface, maybe. But he wasn't just looking for a gig. He was looking for intensity, a shared kind of worldview.
Yeah.
Think about it. X and the Blasters, musically different, sure. But they came from the same LA streets. They shared that same gritty, working class, anti-establishment lyrical core.
I see. They were both pushing back against the glossy 80s sound.
Exactly. Rejecting that polished new wave stuff for something more raw, more rooted in the city's reality.
Yeah.
And Alvin's guitar style, that T-Bone Walker meets punk thing we talked about.
Yeah.
It actually fit perfectly into X's controlled chaos. He could bridge those worlds.
He was the bridge. That makes sense.
And it wasn't just X proper. He was also involved with the Knitters.
Right. The sort of country folk side project of X members.
Yep. Which just shows him constantly probing those connections, right? Between punk and folk and country.
Mm-hmm.
Deep roots music. He was on their first album back in 85, Poor Little Critter on the Road.
And he came back later for the second one, too.
He did. The Modern Sounds of the Knitters in 2005. Still exploring that connection decades later.
That ability to just shift gears from the electric onslaught of X to the acoustic, more traditional sound of the Knitters, it's pretty remarkable.
It really is.
Yeah.
But if you want to talk about the LA scene's interconnectedness, the quintessential supergroup that showed how tight that community was, you have to talk about the Flesh Eaters.
Yes. Legendary status, that lineup.
Totally legendary.
Yeah.
Because back in the early 80s, even while he was still technically a Blaster, Alvin played on their classic album, A Minute to Pray, A Second to Die.
And the lineup on that record, it's insane.
It's a who's who.
Yeah.
You had Alvin plus fellow Blasters Bill Bateman and Steve Berlin, and then John Doe and DJ Bonebreak from X. all on one record.
That's not just a band. That's like a snapshot of the entire LA underground scene at that moment.
Exactly. It captured the energy, synthesized the best of it.
And that project had staying power, didn't it? It wasn't just a one-off.
That's what's amazing. This specific lineup was so potent, so iconic, they kept getting back together. They reunited for the album's 25th anniversary in 2006, did a short tour in 2015.
Wow.
Another run in 2018, which actually led to them making a new album together, I Used to Be Pretty, in 2019.
No way.
Yeah. So it wasn't just nostalgia. It was this deep, recurring creative connection between those specific players. It still worked.
That collaborative spirit seems to define that whole period for him. It wasn't just structured bands.
Not at all. It spilled into weirder, more eccentric stuff, too, like touring as the Pleasure Barons.
Right. With Mojo Nixon and Country Dick Montana from the Beat Farmers.
Can you imagine those shows?
Yeah.
Guaranteed chaos. And yeah, predictably, there's a live album from that, Live in Las Vegas, 1993. Captures some of the madness.
So while he's doing Blasters Reunions, X, Knitters, Flesh Eaters, Pleasure Barons,
yeah,
he's also doing session work?
Constantly. That's the fascinating part. He maintained this super active parallel career as a studio guy, the go-to guitarist for a certain sound.
Who did he play with?
Oh, man, a diverse list. He backed up the folk legend Ramblin' Jack Elliott, the great bluesman Little Milton, singer-songwriters like Katie Moffitt and Sid Straw.
Wow, that's real breadth.
It is. And we can't forget, he played guitar on a couple of tracks for the Gun Club's 1984 album, The Las Vegas Story.
Another hugely influential band, Jeffrey Lee Pierce.
Exactly. So Alvin really had his fingers in all the pies. He wasn't just making his own music. He was like essential connective tissue for that whole roots-adjacent L.A. musical world.
Mm-hmm.
A key player, literally. Okay, so all this collaboration, all these different projects, it was like the ultimate training ground for the solo career he really wanted.
Right, the one he loved the Blasters for.
Exactly. But, ironically, when he finally launched it, it started with a pretty major professional blow.
His first solo album, Romeo's Escape, that was 87, also called Every Night About This Time Over in England.
Yeah. And the critics, they loved it. It got really strong reviews. It clearly laid out the sound he'd been honing and, you know, distinct from the Blasters, showcased his songwriting. But critical success and commercial success were often miles apart, right?
Mm.
The sales were just poor, really poor.
Ouch. And that had consequences.
Big time. That's where the music biz reality bites. Despite how good the record was, the low sales meant his contract with Columbia Records got terminated. They dropped him.
Wow. After just one album. Imagine that feeling. You leave this successful foundational band to go it alone, put out a great record, and boom, you're dropped by the major label.
It's got to be crushing psychologically. It just highlights how tough it is to translate that sort of critical acclaim or cult following into solo stardom, especially back then.
But if there's one thing we're learning about Dave Alvin, it's that he doesn't quit easily.
Not a chance. Tenacity is definitely a theme. So he pivots. He moves away from the major label system, finds a home, finds stability with a respected indie label, Hightone Records.
Okay.
And his second solo album, Blue Blue OVD, comes out in 1991. And this one starts to shift things, gets good reviews again, but crucially, it sells moderately well. It proves he can sustain an independent solo career.
That stability must have been huge, allowed him to breathe and explore more.
Totally. He follows up with Museum of Heart in 93. But then comes a really significant move in 94, King of California.
The acoustic album.
The acoustic album. This was a deliberate choice, a dedicated turn towards acoustic music, stripping it all back.
Why do that then, after finding some footing with the electric stuff?
Well, I think it was a powerful statement. It was him saying, my work is defined by the songs, by the lyrics, by the stories, not just by how loud my guitar is.
Right. Shifting the focus entirely to the songwriting.
Exactly. Stripping the sound back just highlighted the depth of his writing, showed he was way more than just a hotshot electric player. It was a risk, maybe, but a really necessary creative evolution for him, I think.
And he was kind of building his own mythology around this time too, right? With the Blackjack Days nickname.
Yeah, that came from his 1998 album, Blackjack David. The title track inspired the nickname that stuck, Blackjack Dave. It's like he's defining himself through the characters in his songs, the wanderer, the gambler, the storyteller.
Embracing those archetypes.
Mm-hmm. But the absolute peak of his mainstream recognition, the big award, it came in 2000. And from a slightly unexpected direction.
Public Domain, Songs from the Wildland, which wasn't his original song.
No, exactly. It was a collection of traditional folk and blues classics.
Yeah.
Public Domain tunes.
And that won the Grammy.
That won the Grammy Award for Best Contemporary Folk Album. Now, we should pause here because this win is really significant.
Yeah. Why specifically?
Well, it wasn't just a trophy. It was this major recognition of his role, not just as a writer or player, but as a musical historian and interpreter.
It's kind of ironic, isn't it? His biggest award comes from interpreting other people's really old songs, not his own compositions.
It is ironic, but it speaks volumes about his power as an interpreter, his depth of understanding. It acknowledges him as a custodian of American musical tradition.
So on public domain, he wasn't just covering these songs.
No way. He was reinterpreting them. These ancient American tunes, some centuries old, he breathed new life into them, injected them with contemporary clarity, his own narrative focus. That's why the contemporary folk label fits, I think. He made that wild land feel immediate again, relevant now.
That makes sense. He connected the past to the present.
Perfectly put. So after hitting that peak, winning the Grammys with traditional folk, what does he do next?
Knowing him, probably something different again.
Exactly. He makes a conscious choice to return to the sound that first defined him. Electric roots rock. Power trio stuff.
Ah, okay. Full circle, sort of.
Kind of. This brings us to 1111, released in 2011 on Yep Rock Records. And it was a loud record. A deliberate, I'm plugging back in statement.
And how was that received after the acoustic success and the folk Grammy?
The critics definitely noticed. This is the album that sparked that Rolling Stone review calling him the underrecognized guitar hero.
Ah, okay. So the timing was right.
Yeah. It was like after years of acoustic refinement, playing sideman, digging into folk history, the electric guitar player finally got his explicit due in the mainstream critical conversation. It proved he could do both. Master the whisper and the roar. So following those solo highs, the Grammys and the return to rock, one of the really maybe most enduring and frankly heartwarming chapters of his career starts up. The reunion with his brother, Phil.
But not as the Blasters, right? Something different.
Exactly. Not a Blasters reformation, but as like equal partners paying homage together to the music they both grew up loving, their shared foundation.
Okay. So what did that look like?
Their first studio collaboration since way back in the mid-80s Blasters days was Common Ground, came out in 2014. And it focused entirely on covers of songs by one specific artist, Big Bill Brunzi.
Big Bill Brunzi. Okay, why him?
Well, Brunzi is such a key figure. He was one of those guys who successfully made the jump from rural country blues to the more urban blues sound.
Ah, okay. He represents that transition.
Perfectly. That complex intersection of styles that the Alvin Brothers themselves embody. So by covering Brunzi, they weren't just singing old tunes. They were basically reaffirming their shared musical DNA. Going back to the source.
That makes a lot of sense.
And they followed up pretty quickly, too. Lost Time came out in 2015, another collection of covers, this time heavily featuring songs by Big Joe Turner.
The great Jump Blues shouter, another foundational figure from their youth, I bet.
Absolutely. Another cornerstone of that Downey Roots music education they had.
So these albums, Common Ground and Lost Time, they weren't just records. They kind of set up a new way for the brothers to perform together.
Exactly. They established this new, stable, live dynamic. And in these duo shows, Dave Alvin's stage role shifted pretty significantly.
How so?
Well, Phil naturally handled those incredible lead vocals. He's still got that powerhouse voice. But Dave really stepped into the role of, well, MC, master storyteller.
Ah, interesting.
Yeah, he would weave narratives between the songs, give context, tell anecdotes about the artists, about Downey, about their history with the music. And they'd mix in Blasters tunes alongside the covers. But Dave was the guide.
He became the curator on stage, explaining the connections.
That's it. The connective thread, explaining the history, the personal meaning. And that storytelling persona, that became really central to his other collaborations that followed, too. Especially with the legendary Texas singer-songwriter Jimmy Dale Gilmore.
Right. That seemed like a really natural pairing.
It really did. That partnership blossomed into the album Downey to Lubbock in 2018.
Downey to Lubbock. The title says it all, doesn't it?
Perfectly. It's that cultural meeting point. Alvin's California roots, Gilmore's Texas flatland mysticism. It's literally mapping the American musical landscape, coast to heartland, right there in the title.
And I bet the live shows emphasize the stories again.
Oh, absolutely. The strength of their shows was as much in the music as it was in Dave's stories between the songs, connecting the dots for the audience.
And that partnership has lasted, right? They just put out another record.
They did. Really resilient collaboration. Their latest is Texacali, released just this year, 2024.
Texacali, another great title.
Isn't it? But the time between those two Gilmore albums, That period was marked by immense personal struggle for Dave.
Yeah, I heard about that. He had a serious health battle.
Extremely serious. Starting around May 2020, he began what his team described as a grueling 2-year battle with different forms of cancer.
Wow, 2 years.
Yeah. It was a really tough fight. Took him completely off the road, off the stage, right during the peak of the pandemic lockdown, too. Just a brutal time.
That's incredibly sobering. Puts everything else in perspective.
It really does. And his return to performing, it became this powerful symbol of resilience and maybe the healing power of collaboration, too.
When did he come back?
In April 2022, he announced he was ready to return to public performance. And significantly, he chose to do it with Jimmy Dale Gilmore. They booked a series of 9 dates together in California.
He specifically chose to return with Jimmy.
Yeah. And I think that decision really underlines the depth of that partnership. After this life-altering health battle, where all focus had to be on just surviving, he chose to step back onto the stage with a trusted friend, relying on that warmth, that existing musical conversation, to ease back into the demands of performing.
That's really moving.
It is. And you have to think, that personal struggle, it inevitably deepens the emotional resonance of his work since then. Those themes of loss, endurance, memory. They were already in his songs, but now they carry an even greater weight, you know?
So we've covered Dave Alvin, the musician, the singer, the songwriter, this incredibly versatile figure. But his influence, his work, it goes beyond just performing, right? He's always had these parallel things going on.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
We have to talk about his role as a producer and as a writer, a literary writer, and even occasionally an actor.
Let's start with producing. How does that fit in?
Well, his production work feels like a natural extension of that historical sensibility we talked about.
Mm.
He acts like a curator in the studio, too.
How do you know?
He helps artists capture their authentic roots sound, but make sure it has, you know, modern clarity and punch. He's produced records for a really diverse group. People like Chris Gaffney, remember his 95 album, Loser's Paradise?
Vaguely, yeah.
Dave produced that. Also, Tom Russell, The Derailers, Big Sandy and his Fly Right Boys, the country band Red Meat.
Okay, so a real mix within that roots world.
Definitely. And he brings that depth knowledge of musical history into the control room. He even collaborated with the legendary rockabilly pioneer Sonny Burgess, producing him, making sure that foundational sound got captured right for a new audience.
Preserving the legacy through production.
Exactly. And he's still very active. He produced Carolyn Wonderland's fantastic 2021 album, Tempting Fate.
Oh, yeah. That got great reviews.
It did. And he's apparently lined up to produce her next one, too, Truth Is, coming out in 2025. So he clearly has this knack for finding raw, soulful talent and helping them translate that feeling onto tape, make it last.
Okay, before we get to his writing, which seems like maybe his most consistent side gig, let's just quickly touch on the film and TV stuff.
Right. Not a huge part of his career, but it's there. We mentioned the Blasters showing up in Streets of Fire back in 84.
Yeah.
But he also took on actual acting roles in a couple of indie movies, Border Radio and Floundering.
Huh. Didn't know that.
And maybe most fittingly, given the kind of dusty, noirish feel of many of his songs, he popped up on the FX series Justified in 2011.
Oh, Justified. This makes perfect sense. Elmore Leonard territory. Modern Western.
Exactly. It's like the visual echo of the kind of blues and folk ballads he champions. A perfect cameo.
Okay, but the writing, the poetry, that seems like a much bigger piece of the puzzle.
It absolutely is. We really can't talk about Dave Alvin fully without acknowledging that he's maintained this serious parallel career as a published poet for decades.
It's not just a hobby, then.
Oh, no, not at all. He's not just a musician who scribbles poems on the side. He's a recognized figure in the LA literary scene. His first book of poetry, Manna, Big Joe and the 4th of July, came out way back in 1986.
Wow, 86, right around when he left the Blasters.
Exactly. And his second collection, Any Rough Times Are Now Behind You, followed in 96.
And the themes in his poetry, do they connect to his music?
Directly. It's often the same territory. Working class stories, meditations on that Southern California landscape, the beauty and the grit characters navigating hard times, loss, memory. His poems have shown up in respected anthologies and journals, too, like Caffeine, Rattler, Poetry Loves Poetry.
So it's all connected, the songs, the poems?
It really feels like it. The poetry and prose are just maybe a different delivery system for the same core narratives, the same obsessions that fuel his songs.
And he kind of confirmed that himself recently, didn't he, with that big collection?
He did. That really cemented the unified vision. In 2022, he released New Highway, and the subtitle tells you everything. Selected lyrics, poems. poems, prose, essays, eulogies, and blues.
Wow. Lyrics, poems, prose, essays, eulogies.
Right. That subtitle is like the Rosetta Stone for his whole career. It shows that in his mind, a eulogy he wrote for a friend, a poem about growing up in Downey, and the lyrics to, say, Long White Cadillac, they all come from the same place, the same creative wellspring.
It confirms that the core of his art isn't really about the instrument he's holding.
Exactly. It's about the story, the narrative, and the pen that shapes it, whether it ends up as a song or a poem or an essay. That's the constant. Hashtag tag outro. So when we try to wrap this all up, look back at this whole deep dive, you realize Dave Elvin's career isn't really a straight line at all, is it? It's more like a fractal pattern or something.
How do you mean?
Well, those core themes, history, place, resilience, the power of narrative, they just keep repeating themselves. But across all these different mediums, different roles.
Yeah, he mastered shifting between them. The tight structure of leading a band like the Blasters.
Right. Then the seeming chaos of those punk-adjacent scenes.
The quiet introspection of being a folk songwriter.
And then stepping up as this authoritative voice of musical history, the interpreter, the producer.
His whole career path is just a masterclass in versatility and sheer endurance, too.
Totally. He proved he could be that electric guitar hero who helped shape roots rock.
Right, the Rolling Stone line.
Yeah. And yet, his biggest mainstream award, the Grammys, came for being a folk historian preserving the blues legacy. It's fascinating.
His journey really shows that true artistic depth. It often requires more than just musical talent, right? It's about that willingness to embrace multiple ways of communicating.
Poetry, prose,
yeah.
Production, whatever it takes to get the story told.
And that dedication to the narrative and to the source material, the history, that feels like why he's still such a vital figure. He always points back to the tradition, even while he's pushing it forward somehow.
Well said. He keeps the roots alive by making them relevant now.
So maybe we can leave you, the listener, with this final thought to chew on. We started out asking if he was the under-recognized guitar hero.
Mm-hmm.
But when you look at the incredible scope of his career, everything we've talked about, does his enduring legacy ultimately rest more on the power of his pen? Whether that pen is writing Grammy-winning lyrics, quiet acoustic ballads, published poetry.
Or does it rest more on the undeniable influence of his guitar?
Mm-hmm.
That aggressive electric sound that started with the Blasters and keeps resurfacing.
Yeah.
The volume of his amp.
The pen or the amp. Maybe it's both. Something to think about. Thanks for diving deep with us today.